Thank you, Dee. She wanted to get off. Hi, my name is Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sharon.
And it's really nice to be here this morning with you. We look so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed for a Sunday morning, and it always amazes me because I usually didn't know what day it was, especially if it was Sunday, but many Sunday mornings I would be stuck to something. High or low or whatever, it didn't, you know. So when I'm up on a Sunday morning feeling good and clear-eyed, I always just am grateful. I'm so grateful, and I've just enjoyed myself so much this weekend, and I got to meet the Duffy and Mike show, and they're going to be on my Christmas list. So when I take my Christmas list out one year and me and my son go traveling, knocking on all the AA phone numbers and addresses I have for a cup of coffee across the country, I'm going to come to their house too. So, you know, and your theme is a world in recovery, and I was thinking about that. You know, I just have this incredible network of people that I love in Alcoholics Anonymous all over. And it's such a sense of community. And I live in Los Angeles, and there's really not a big sense of community in my neighborhood. And we didn't even meet until the earthquake, and we were all out in the street in Ohio. I'm your neighbor. I mean, it's just, it's a different feeling there. But Alcoholics Anonymous has provided me with that sense of community that I craved. The feeling of being a part of something and having a purpose and some sense of worth that I craved when I came here. So I feel a sense of your community. I feel part of your recovery this weekend. And nobody's mentioned this podium, and I don't know if you can see the color of this podium. It's kind of I don't know. Whoever did it is. I used to live in apartments painted this color. These colors, you know. Take 16. Somebody took some acid here. Yeah? Kind of a purple haze color here, and the green. There's not even a Crayola name to that green. Good orange sunshine one night. But the beauty, I mean, it was the first thing I noticed when I walked in Friday night. And, you know, Joe, the Friday night speaker, I mean, I could just imagine him with that froed out hair behind this podium. I mean, he kind of fit, you know. And Sean with his arms stretched wailing at the moon, I mean, he fit, you know, he fit. But Bo, the Al-Anon speaker, I just could imagine him having it in the driveway with a sign on it, say, take me, please, you know? But I've certainly enjoyed myself this weekend and meeting all of you and getting to see some of the speakers that I know and love. And we spend more time at these things together than we do when we're in town. And it's been just a joy. It's been an absolute joy to be with you and to you know, I just feel like we're so brave. It takes so much courage to stay sober. You know, and you guys, with what you did last night, it takes a lot of courage, you know, the coming to and being amongst us and being brave and taking risks and stretching and growing and staying sober through it. We have a lot of courage, and I'm real proud of us. I'm real proud of us. And, you know, I grew up in a small community. I grew up with a sense of community. I grew up with a family that's still normal. My parents are married 54 years in next month. And, you know, he still gives her a kiss and thanks her for dinner and tells her she's a great cook and pats her on the fanny every now and then. And I was just home looking for something wrong with them. I mean, I sat there looking for like 4 days, something wrong with them. And I've got 3 other siblings, and they're fine. They're absolutely wonderful people, and nobody's got any ill at ease and sickness but me. And so I stood out from an early age. I was just stood out. And, you know, my favorite movie growing up was The Lost Weekend, and that was a little, wasn't The Wizard of Oz, you know. And I just always seemed to have a loud head, a very loud head that didn't get quiet until I got drunk for the first time. I had sipped some of those screwdrivers my mother never drank at those Czechoslovakian wedding dances I grew up at. And, you know, it was always around because my dad had a business and booze was always there. And Santa Claus would come once a year and he's got that bottle of booze at the end of his little visit. And, you know, and his nose got redder. And, you know, but there was always booze around, but I don't remember it changing me until the night I was out on that country road in Iowa. And that's where I grew up. My first resentment, Iowa. But sitting out in the country road with the moon out and the radio's blaring and you all meet out there on a country road and I'm with the neighbor boys and they're, you know, they had me along because I was just kind of a tomboy. And I just was with them and one night we ended up with the football players and, you know, the girls that had those tight sweaters that Sean was talking about with his daughter and those thin skirts and those, just they just fit so well in that. And, you know, their hair would just do the right thing always. And they were kind of known to have a little reputation, you know. And I was out there with these people that night, and I was definitely the youngest one there. And I didn't feel a part of. And we started passing around Canadian Club and Schlitz beer. And I was sitting on the hood of that car, and you know, it went around. And it went down fine. You know, it went down great. I liked the way it burned going down. It felt good. And I don't know when it happened, but at some point during the evening, I looked down, and my skinny little calves seemed to grow like Marilyn's, you know, kind of filled out. And I looked down, and my little bumps had kind of protruded a little bit, you know. And I'll tell you, Lauren Bacall slid off the top of that car that night. And we held the cigarette just so, and we held the bottle just so, and life began. And everybody that lived in my head just got drunk. They got quiet, and they got drunk, and we had a good time. And the next morning, you know, I had a blackout, and I guess I drove a car. I did some fun things. And the next morning, I went off to church with my family, and I felt a little remorseful and a little bad and, you know, physically I felt bad, but I couldn't wait to do it again. I couldn't wait to do it again. Something that good, it already had hooked me from the very, very first. And it was hard to get. In high school, I managed to get it, and I managed to manipulate. And I was home recently for a class reunion. And we were going around the table with these group of girls that I named the Savages. We were called the Savages. And we were talking about the one time they really got in trouble and got grounded for a month. And I was the other player in every one of the stories. You know, I was the other member. I was the troublemaker. I was the instigator. But I had a good front going because I'm really good at that. I'm really good at keeping you at arm's length, not letting you know too much about me. I was in and out of that confessional in 30 seconds. Boy, I had it categorized. I'd say it so fast the priest wouldn't even know what I was saying. He'd just give me 5 Hail Marys and 5 Our Fathers, because if you were in there longer than 2 minutes, you were a bad girl. You know, so I had to look good in confession. I had to look good at school. I had 2 inches under my name in the yearbook. I did everything. I was involved in everything. But I couldn't wait to go to Swisher on a Friday or Saturday night or the Red Barn and, you know, dance with those guys with the V-neck sweaters smelling like Jade East and English leather. And, you know, they would breathe on you and they'd have that alcohol smell. And I knew we were going to go out in the back seat and have some of that alcohol. I couldn't wait. You know, I couldn't wait. You know, just the call of the wild would hit me. And I got in a little trouble, but I got out. And then I went off to college and it was like, the stops were pulled out. It was the late 60s, and it wasn't the just say no generation. It was just say thanks, you know. And we took a lot of stuff with our alcohol. We took a lot of stuff. And I never said, what'll it do to me? I always said more. That was just the way I said more, you know. Is that it? More. And I took a lot of stuff with my alcohol. And I had, you know, I had tried to be in the sorority and go to this education school, and I had a scholarship to go to Boulder, Colorado, but I had met a man, and the man was going to college in my hometown, and we had gotten pinned, and so I gave up the scholarship in Boulder, Colorado, and went to college close to home. And in my first year of college, I caught him with his tutor, and then that was over, and I remember pulling a window shade on that feeling. I remember getting drunk at that feeling that night. I was so crushed and so hurt. This was the man I was going to build a life with. And I remember my mother saying, aren't you going to cry? And I said, You know, I had a few belts and I was ready to go have a few more. And I stuffed that feeling. I put it right down in my right toe, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous, you come here and you start working the steps and you get a sponsor. You know, they walk into your life and they walk into that dark room that you've pushed everything and shoved and made Pandora's boxes out of and locked and keyed and, you know, locks on the windows. And they walk around the room and they pull up window shades, you know, and the light comes in and the snakes come out and, you know, it's like, oh, it's like, you know, vampires. It's just the light hitting you and it's painful. But when I started to let those feelings come to the surface and work inventories, I didn't have to do it alone. You know, there were people there to guide me through all the stuffed, painful feelings I drank at and drank over and the victimization and the self-pity and the poor me's and if onlys and what's wrong with you's and all of those. I just shoved it all down in me and stuffed it and drank. Because alcohol worked. Alcohol made me feel like Lauren Bacall. Alcohol made me feel omnipotent. It gave me a sense of power. And it also made me not need you. And sometime around my 18, 19 years, my father and I began to have some trouble. I had deactivated from the sorority. I had gone to 1968. I had gone to the Democratic National Convention. I had kind of turned my head around there. I went with my sorority sisters and came back with Dick Gregory as my best friend, you know, and I kind of had this mental switch happen, and I began to have an outlet for my anger, which was being mad at the war in Vietnam, being mad at the government, being mad at my dad, being mad at the Catholic Church. I went to try to talk to a priest and had a huge fight with him, and then I had a suicide attempt. I woke up one morning and started cutting my wrist because it just seemed like the thing to do. Took a couple hits off the hash pipe and started cutting my wrists. And my dad and the priest came down to try to talk to me, took me out to eat, and the priest and I got roaring drunk that night. We got smashed. And my father's not understanding what's happening to daughter number two here, because it's just the rest of them aren't doing this, you know. I was really beginning to worry him a little. And so my dad would try to talk to me, and he would try to come to me, and I would push him away with anger and point the finger at him and his life, and if only, and you know, I just said, you weren't there when I was 14, and I really laid it on him, and I told him all the things I was doing and who I was doing them with. I woke him up once in the middle of the night and told them I had changed my name from Sharon to Cher, you know, and it was S-H-A-R-E, you know, because I share and share alike, Dad, you know, and and he saw who was with me, you know, with the no shoes on and the bells around his ankle and the long hair and the eyeballs spinning, you know, and he just went back to bed, and my mother sat there and just went, oh, Sharon, you know, and so I went back to school and I told them they're now going to be Marge and Frank, no more Mom and Dad, and that was my big awakening on, you know, some booze and a lot of LSD that night. That was truth for the moment. And I was always grasping for truth. Where was it? It's you know, I'm 19 and it's over. It's over. I ended up running to New York and taking geographics. And I didn't know I'm doing that. I didn't know I'm taking geographics. It was just a fresh start. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a speaker named Norm Alpe used to talk a lot when I was new. And Norm used to tell me truth. You know, Norm said the reason the grass was greener is because the other guy took care of his lawn. Made sense, you know? Made sense. But Norm was a good guy, you know? Good old-timers don't give you a dose of truth without a dose of hope. And he said, if you're a newcomer, you got a lot of fertilizer. We're going to make a good lawn, you know? So we've been making a good lawn for a lot of years now, and I enjoy my dichondra. It's a lot better than barren desert. But I'm in New York, and I'm looking for truth like a mad woman. I'm taking enough stuff to keep me awake all the time so I don't miss truth. And I'm taking a lot of the other stuff so that I can find truth, and I'm drinking all the time. And I work at an ad agency where they drink two-hour lunches, and they can close your door and have a hangover. And I'm always hallucinating. It was just that whole 10 months I hallucinated. And, you know, and I started to breathe in a paper bag because I had anxiety attacks all the time. And it was just insane. And I called my father and said, you know, I want to go back to college because I was tired. I was tired. I needed a rest. And I went back to college and I went back to those art classes and I sat in front of an empty canvas And it was like my creativity had kind of run out my sleeve somewhere along the line. And I don't know when it left me. I don't know when it was gone. It was very depressing. You know, I don't know. I don't know where it went. I don't know the night that I sat in a bar and the bartender said, you know, if I give you this drink here, you're going to have to give me that last piece of your dignity. You know, I don't know what night that happened. I don't know what night the bartender said, well, here's your drink, but I got to take your creativity now. You know, I don't know when that happened. I just drank because I had no choice and I gave up pieces of my soul as I went along. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was empty, absolutely empty. And I ended up fighting with my father again, and that was it. You know, we were not to have a nice moment together for a lot of years. And I went to Colorado, and I met Bob Dylan and came to California. And I mean, I thought it was Bob Dylan. I wasn't sure. And it was near Aspen. Could have been him. And, you know, so I ended up at a commune, and I left there. And, you know, I just knew when it was always time to leave. It was just, I just knew when it was time to go. And I always had that feeling when it was time to go. And it was just last week I was thinking, you know what? Nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous has ever said to me it's time to go. And I've never had that feeling here that it's just time to go now. You know, I've used up my welcome here. You know, it just, that has never happened to me here. But it was time to go, and I ended up back in with my mother and father, and I'm 21 years old, and it's over. It's absolutely over. Nobody knows alcoholism. I go to the family doctor, and you know, they treated me with Valium. And my mother said I could stay there as long as I stayed out of my father's way. And just not to take any drugs in the house. And, you know, why can't you just meet a nice man and get your life together? And I sat in those local taverns in that local town and drank and looked at all of you and judged all of you in there, you know, every night. And I was in there every night, just a loser. And somebody came along and said, I'll take care of you. Music to my ears. I was tired of taking care of myself. You know, my dad and I couldn't sit in the same room. We couldn't eat at the same table. We couldn't drive in the same car. There was so much tension in the house. And, you know, that Thanksgiving at my grandmother's house, they didn't even set me a place with the adults. I sat with the children. You know, they just didn't know alcoholism. They didn't know what was wrong with me. I was such an odd person in that family. And I met this guy that I'd gone to high school with, and he had an organic farm. He had bought 85 acres of land in northern Wisconsin. And it was a community of organic people up there, and I thought, okay, well, I guess we're going to try this health thing for a while. And I had this blown gallbladder and pancreatitis, and nobody found it, and nobody knew it for a while. And so I was sick a lot of the time, and I couldn't eat, and I couldn't drink. And so they would give me organic pot to smoke all the time. So I was smoking organic pot, you know, from morning to night, and There was no nicotine there. There was no, it wasn't organic, you know. When we would have our little hootenannies, we would drink organic dandelion wine and little tiny bottles of organic dandelion wine. And, you know, these people, every once in a while, I'd be sitting there and that banjo playing would get to me. Pete Seeger would start to sound like Big Bird, and, you know, the snow would get heavy, you know, and it looked like it's going to come down for a few days, and, you know, the cat's tail would start flicking back and forth, and I'm sitting in my rocking chair reading my Mother Earth news, you know, ready to just fly out of the chair, rocking as fast as I can, and then, you know, then the dog comes up and looks at me like, do something, you know, and so I would just roll into town, which was, there was the close town, it was a couple miles away, it had a general store, and I would buy 2 cheap gallons of wine, and I would come back and put it on the table, and he'd go to bed, because he knew what I was like when I was drunk. And I would just feel better knowing it was in the house. And, you know, a couple of drinks later, the cat, the dog, and I were all relaxed and happy. We're having a good time. And, you know, the snowplow comes through about 4 in the morning. I got my bottle. I'm cheering him through, you know. And I got the Rolling Stones on, the cowboy boots, and the truck driver mouth. And I'm feeling better, you know. And he'd wake up, you know. He'd wake up, and he'd stand at the doorway, and he'd look at me with that look. You know, we've all seen that look in somebody's eyes, and a lot of Al-Anons have given that look, you know, given that look. And I always read that look as, you're not good enough. What's wrong with you? Why do you have to act like that? Why can't you just grow up? You know, you could have been anything when you were growing up, and look at you. What happened to your potential? You're a loser. I always read the look as that. And since I've been sober and been a mom and sponsored people and been to Al-Anon, I know what that look is all about. That look is the look of a lot of pain. You know, it's got some compassion behind it sometimes. It's a lot of, they don't understand some people. And I didn't know that because, see, I'm a self-centered, selfish person. You know, and it just centers in the mind. Boy, I can just think my way right through destruction, walk over the edge and just enjoy the fall. You know, and it's like a boat out on a quiet lake and the point of the boat, and if you sit at the point of the boat on a quiet lake in the morning, all you're seeing is that point of the boat cut through the water, and it's quiet and the birds are singing and it's beautiful. But if you turn around and look at the wake of the boat, you know, it's touching every shore. You know, it's churning up weeds and cutting up fish. And, you know, but I was always so self-centered, I never looked at what my alcoholism touched. I never looked at what it was doing to the people around me because, first of all, it hurt too much. I knew it was over for me. I knew the golden child, but it was dead and gone. I just had to keep looking at the front of the boat because I was that self-centered, and that's what alcohol allowed me to do. And, you know, I just made a decision that night with this guy that alcohol was more fun than him. And it took me a while to get rid of him and get rid of that organic community. And so finally I was left alone with my half acre of organic marijuana I was growing. And I harvested it, and I had a great time, and Clarence the farmer would bring the booze, and I was drinking my wine, and he'd bring booze, hard stuff at night, and he'd come up on his tractor up the lane, and I'd just feel better knowing it was coming. And the reason Clarence was on his tractor is because his license had been pulled for too many DWIs, so he was on his tractor, and he was my only friend. And then his wife took away the keys to the tractor, so I was really alone. And I was fine with it, though. I was just fine with it. And I harvested this pot. It took me 3 days by horseback and the wood stove going with the boiling water and putting the roots in it and upside down in the machine shed and back out on the horse and wrapping it in blankets. And I just was obsessed for 3 days. And I was drinking and eating it and rubbing in it and just enjoying it, you know. And I went to turn my pot into money, and I forgot the pot. I had driven 45 miles into town, and I forgot it. So what I did was the next best thing was I turned around, and just luckily in town that night there was a carnival. And I looked at the merry-go-round and heard the music and the lights of the Ferris wheel. I thought, I always wanted to be a gypsy. You know, and I packed up my pot and some clothing and my dog and my car with the big sun painted on the hood and the bald tires, and it should have just written "bust me" on the back, you know. I just and I got a job. Just happened to have an opening, and I just happened to pass, and I became a shooting gallery girl. And so I worked my way down south, and I thought, well, I better call my mom. And about somewhere in Arkansas, I called my mom, and I said, "Well, Mom, I left the farm, and I left all the things up there, and you know, maybe the cat might want to, you know, be fed, and." Maybe those sheep are out by now, and maybe you'd like your antique furniture back you had given me, and maybe you're going to have to go get it. And she started to cry. She said, "You've done what?" You know, my mother cries when I call home because I just started to break her heart now. She couldn't do it anymore. You know, I'm a mom today. My kid likes to spin around till he gets dizzy and loves the smell of gas, and, you know, and... But he's also got a way to go. You know, he knows about a spiritual path. You know, he knows about self-worth. So I don't know. But my mom had to take care of all that stuff. But I'm sitting at the front of the boat, just looking at the quiet lake. I'm not looking behind me. It's what it's doing to people who love me. And I met him, and he had a pet skunk. And so we took up housekeeping on the road. And the skunk didn't like the dog, and the dog didn't like the skunk. And it should have been a clue. But for... For 2 years, we hung in there, and we got busted for drugs in Bogalusa, Louisiana. And I had enough on me for sales and possession, which was a felony. So I went off to maximum security, and he went off to maximum security, and the carnival left town. See ya. Nobody brought me magazines and cigarettes. And I was in there about a week, and they said that I had a visitor. So I went to this building, and I was in handcuffs, and they threw me in the room, and there's my father sitting there. And I thought, oh, my God. And I went and sat next to him in a chair, and he had that set jaw look. And I couldn't reach out and hug him, and he couldn't reach out and hug me, and we were inches away from each other that day. And about 2 years ago when I went home, I said to him, I said, Dad, you know, what did I say that day? You know, really, I don't really remember much. And he told me, you said you weren't guilty. Not my fault. No, not my fault. It's never my fault. And so the attorney took my dad's money and never did anything. And finally, after 31 days, they cut me loose and said, go make some money or you're going to do hard time. You're going to pay a big fine. And that's what I ended up doing, was paying a lot of money so that I could stay out of jail. And I found New Orleans and I fell in love. And that's where I drank for the next 3.5 years. And I drank in the nice places, and I ended up on Lower Decatur Street, where it's you can smell the bathroom when you walk up to the bar. And I danced on Bourbon Street, and I was one of those drunken baby grand piano dancers who try to do a little number up there on the baby grand, but I'd be so drunk that I'd get my fishnet stocking stuck in the palm tree that was on the wall, you know, because they put up with staples, and I'd kind of lean against this palm tree, and my fishnets would get stuck in there, and I'd try to slither around with this little number, and, you know, sometimes I'd rip it off, and the leg would go through the side, and, you know, then after work, I would go walk my skunk, and we'd go out for, you know, we'd go out for a nice nightcap, which always would last till I had to go back to work, and the skunk was all, he liked rum and coke, and then, you know, and he'd pass out on his back with a maraschino cherry in his mouth, and yeah, I'd be passed out next to the skunk, and it was, you know, it was colorful, let's just say. I became a bartender, and I did that a little bit better, and I worked at some nice places. I got fired for being drunk on a job in one of the nicer hotels, so I was blackballed from working in any of those nice places. I was in the computer as being drunk on the job. And I started working local joints because, you know what? You come in my bar and you've got a local, you know, you're a bartender. I'm going to go to your place when I'm off, you know, and I'm going to take care of you real well so that when I go in your bar, you're going to take care of me. And you've got a tab at my bar and I got a tab at your bar. And we kind of took care of each other that way. And I could pass out and come to in the Bastille for 2 days, you know, and nobody ever steal my purse because they had put it under the bar, you know, and I had blackouts that would, I'd come to out in the bayou somewhere and half in and half out my door. My blackouts were getting to be, I wasn't taking care of myself as much in my blackouts. I was beginning to hang around people that weren't really nice to me. And this boyfriend I had, for 2 years, we just, I don't know why we stuck together. I don't know what it was, but he had a heroin habit, and I didn't understand that, you know, and he didn't understand my alcoholism. And, you know, he'd come home, and I wouldn't judge his tugboat days, and he'd be 3 days on and 5 days off or something, and I remember the one night he came home with a broken leg because he had hung his leg off the side of the tugboat when he was loaded and it got scrunched. So he came home early that night and I had my new best friend there, which was Captain Gill, the one-armed sea captain. And, you know, and we were just drinking, having a good time, but, you know, this guy didn't understand that. And so he's got the broken leg trying to fight with the guy with the one arm. And, we lived above a biker bar, and the biker guys would come up and watch us and laugh and have a good time and go back down, and they would just think we were insane, you know? And it was about that time that my parents came to visit for my sweet little Iowa mom and dad. And, you know, my new black eye was there, and, you know, my mom tried to talk to me. They took us out to eat, and they didn't care less about him. He put the snake in my dad's face upon meeting him, And you know, my dad just sat there with that set jaw, and my mom just cried. And when they went home to Iowa that day, I wanted to go with them so bad because I was tired. I was tired. And I knew if I went, nothing would change. I didn't know alcoholism, but I knew nothing would change. I knew it was over. I absolutely knew it was over, and I was beginning to get into self-destructive situations. I tried to be suicidal, but I wasn't good at it. You know, I just was never good at it. It was never right, and it was never enough, and it hurt, and I'd stop, you know. And so I just went and found situations where I could be the victim, you know, because I have no responsibility in it if I'm the victim. And I did that real well. I did that real well. And I have my heart probably broke for the last time that day when my parents drove back home that day. And I knew nothing would change. And I went and sat and ordered my rock glass full of Jose Cuervo Gold, neat. You know, and I put it down, and I had another one, and I put it down, and my head didn't shut up. It told me what I was, No Lauren Bacall appeared in the back bar mirror that night. No. It just told me exactly what I was, which was a loser, somebody who just is the scum of the earth, and it never made me feel better that night. Alcohol didn't. And it was going to do that to me periodically, and I didn't know that that was part of the disease of alcoholism. I just felt absolutely betrayed. You know, I couldn't have put words on it at the time, but it made me panic. And 1975 was not a good year for me. My best friend was shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day. I was 2 feet inside the door in a blackout. And Michael was, he was a good guy. He had a gun because he was a bouncer at Pat O'Brien's. But Michael, you know, I walk to the edge with people. Let's party for 10 days and go insane and walk to the edge and hang 10. I loved it. You know, and some people never came back and Michael didn't come back. Michael leveled the gun and the policeman killed him. And I was 2 feet inside the door in a blackout when I came to. And Norm Alpe used to talk about seconds and inches. Whew. I knew what he meant. You know, we've all got our seconds and inches that we get to be so lucky to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the fellowship sitting here today. Because there are people a stone's throw from here will never know that Alcoholics Anonymous exists for the alcoholic. And it's just by seconds and inches that we get to be here. And I ended up running to New York and back to California and running, panicked. Ended up back in New Orleans, and my best friends didn't even want me around anymore. I couldn't get my old job back on Lower Decatur Street. I ended up going to Hawaii with some guy and never saw him again after Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood. That's where I first saw the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, was in Barney's Beanery, and a friend of mine named Chris was too drunk to drive to a meeting, so the bartender called her a cab, and she had the book under her arm, and she went out the door with her book to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I gave her a toast. I remember that. And I didn't know that was going to be my Eskimo. Chris was going to be my Eskimo into Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. I couldn't get a job. They asked me to leave after 10 minutes. I was 170-plus pounds, a bloated mess. I had splotches on my cheeks. I didn't look in you in the eye anymore. I would wear a Panama hat and a big red dashiki. And I was unemployable. I had no money, but I managed to get drunk. And I slept in hallways, and I slept, you know, people's floors. I slept wherever. It didn't matter. But I managed to keep getting drunk. And I went to Palm Springs one night on the back of a Harley because I love bikes. God, I love bikes. There's something really fast and furious and dangerous about it, you know. And I used to sit on the back of a bike and give you my one-fingered peace sign, you know, and just think, you suckers out there with your mortgages and your bank accounts, and I'm free, you know. Yeah, free I was, you know. I had a backpack that I carried a book around in it called Be Here Now, you know, and I had no idea how to be here now, none at all. And I went out to Palm Springs with these guys, and they left me, and I said, where are you going? I thought we were going to party. And they said, nah, it was windy going through the desert, need a little extra weight on the back tire. Thanks so much. Fatso, you know. And I had become the lower companion. And I met two more guys that night. I don't remember much about the evening, thank God, but when I came to, I was in an apartment somewhere with no furniture, and they were kicking me in the face with their boots. And I had had violent DTs. You know, when I would have a DT, I would have those kind of choking me kind of. And I thought, is this a DT or is it real? And I realized it was happening. And somewhere during the course of the evening where they broke my jaw in three places and broke my nose and raped me and took me outside of town and threw me off the side of the road in the desert, somewhere in the course of that evening, I stopped screaming. And to me, that was my surrender. That was the ego giving up. I had no more answers at that point. And that was my surrender, and that was my God's window of opportunity to come in and just grab me. Because when I laid there, coming to, when I heard the car door slam, I thought, they're coming back, I better get up. And I put my head up off the sand, and I heard a voice, and the voice said, get up, I want to live. Who said that? Not me. You know, absolutely not me. And I got up, and I guess I got to somebody's condominium down this blacktop road where the gardener found me. You know, a foot from the pool in a lawn chair. Another foot, you'd have another speaker. And seconds and inches, you know. And the next time I came to, I'm laying in a hospital, and the police are around me. And I have to write because I can't talk, and they're prepping me for surgery. And on this clipboard where I'm trying to write where I was and what their names were, and I was, you know, this wasn't going to happen in their town. They seemed very concerned. I was getting a lot of attention here in this emergency room. And I saw this word in front of my name. They had my stats down on this clipboard, and the word was victim. And if this broken face could have smiled, boy, I thought, they know, all right. It was like I had arrived. That's what alcoholism had given me, was the opportunity to be victim. And I went into surgery, and I heard that voice again, which was truth finally happening for me. It said, you know, it's not your dad's fault. These guys didn't really even put you here. Catholic Church, your sister in the Mensa, George, who broke your heart at 18, it's not their fault. You did this to you. And I heard that, and I didn't know what to do with it, but what had happened was I was beginning to get psychically changed. Something had changed deep down within me. I had been touched by something other than myself. And I laid in the hospital for 2 weeks, and nobody sent me an airline ticket. That's God working. Nobody came and said, let's go start over in Phoenix, Arizona. They have drive-through liquor stores. I know you like it there, you know. And nobody said that to me. Nobody came. I was left alone. And what happened was when I got out, this man I had met at Barney's Beanery felt sorry for me and said I could come stay with him. Because they had caught these guys, I had to go back to court, I had to go back to these doctors, and the bottom line was I was tired. I was plain, worn out. And he would buy me red wine before he'd go off to work every morning. And it was cheap red wine, and I'd unscrew the top of the wine, and I'd put my straw through there and stick my straw through the wires on my face in the hole where the tooth had been, and I'd suck on the red wine. And there was no more magic in alcohol. It was like drinking Kool-Aid. And I maintained I would drink a bottle of wine from morning to night. I would drink it, and that was all I would do, is just sit there and drink it. Sip it all day long. And I don't know, I think I was there about a week and a half, and he said I had to leave. I was depressing him. And I called my mom. Now, my mom had known something had happened to me because she had gotten a phone call from this hospital, but the person neglected to tell her what hospital I was in. So my mother, for 2 nights, and my sister in New York, dialed long distance trying to find their daughter, her sister. And it took them 2 days to find me, that I was going to be okay. So for 2 nights, my mother didn't know if her second daughter was going to be okay. And when I called her, she didn't say, oh my God, let me come get you. She said words that she doesn't even know where she got. She said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why did you go to the Salvation Army? And my mother always sent me something. And it was just seconds and inches. $20, you'd have another speaker. I know it in my heart. And I called Chris because her number was there, the girl who was drunk in the bar. And I didn't associate Alcoholics Anonymous. It was absolutely God working in my life. And I called Chris, and Chris said, I can't help you, but Suzanne can. And she seemed to make Suzanne out to be this sort of secret number. She wasn't going to give it to me unless I would really use it. And so she threatened me, you know, all right, I'll do it. And I didn't know that Chris wasn't sober that day. Chris never got sobriety. Chris would have a little bit of sobriety and drink again. And the last time I saw Chris, she was in a wheelchair, and it was St. John's Hospital, and it was where we had a meeting on Saturday night, and they wheeled in the people off the ward, and Chris, nobody was home in her eyes anymore. You know, there was some drool coming out of the corner of her mouth. And she was 30 years old, and she died of alcoholism. But Chris got me to Suzanne, and Suzanne was an active member of the Pacific Group in West Los Angeles, and I had this wired mouth, so I couldn't really talk. And she didn't care. She just said, don't drink anything and put your joint down. I thought, how does she know I have both? You know? She got my attention, and I sat on the steps of the liquor store, and these two beautiful women came at me out of this Volkswagen with, Sean talked about the teeth, you know, and that's what I remember, with the teeth, you know. Beautiful, shiny hair and teeth. And I thought, if they only knew what they were putting in their car, they wouldn't want me. They wouldn't want me. You know, and they put me in the back of this car, and they seemed to talk to me all the time. Every red light, they'd turn around and talk to me about themselves. I thought, my first thought, self-centered thought, was nobody wants to know about me, you know. And I had this newspaper clipping in my pocket just in case they'd ask. You know, I could pull it out. Unemployed bartender was, you know, all that stuff, you know, from the Palm Springs paper. And I never once had to pull that out of my pocket. Nobody really cared to know about me. They just wanted to talk about themselves. And we got to this church, and I thought, oh, here we go. Okay, it's, you know, It's how I have to do something for eternity now, and I have to do something forever, because I had been with the Krishnas, I had been with the Jesus Freaks in Laguna, I had been with the Pentecostals, and when they wanted a commitment from me, I would pick up my backpack and say, I live a day at a time, thank you very much. I cannot commit to you, and I would leave. And little did I know that when I came here, that was what you live by, a day at a time. And nobody asked me to come, to leave. They just said, come, welcome. The man at the door said, welcome, and they put me in this room, and I don't know, I'm even at Alcoholics Anonymous. All I know is that I seemed to get a lot of attention that night. I don't know how they knew I was new, you know. I've got these broken hirachis, my jeans are ripped, my t-shirt's bleach stained, my face is on crooked, I got all these wires, my nose is over here, I look like a raccoon, I hadn't bathed. I don't know when I stopped bathing, when the shower hurt, I think. But, you know, I just hadn't taken care of myself. And also I was detoxing. Sean talked about detoxing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what I did. I had no insurance. I didn't know I could go to a hospital. You know, nobody said we're going to drop you off at the emergency room. They just said, don't drink and use and we'll pick you up tomorrow night. Nobody even gave me a choice. Do you want to go to a meeting? You know, I was a newcomer. I looked like a newcomer. I smelled like a newcomer, and they seemed to be really happy about that. You know, there was no ifs, ands, or buts about this one. You know, she needs us. And the sponsors were hoping, you know, the sponsors of the people that were working with me were the old timers, and they sent over their babies to learn to work with a real wet one, you know. They told me later, we were hoping that you were going to make it, Sharon, but we were hoping we didn't have to get too involved, you know, because I was really a mope. And there's a man in the room, Chuck, who remembers me at my first meeting. It always does my heart good when there's somebody here who saw me come in. So I never want to forget, never want to forget. That's where I get to start if I'm so lucky, if I go back out the doors. They took me home, and, you know, the man at the podium, I don't remember what he said other than he waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill, and it seemed like I identified with him. You know, there was just a little bit of identification which gave me just a touch of hope. Something I hadn't even known for so long was the word hope. You know, that's something that we have just so much around here to give to each other is hope. And it makes so much difference out of fanning the ember of life in people. It just gives you just another little reason to go through the day is hope. I didn't know what that was. I didn't know that's what I was feeling, but I was feeling a little hope. And they took me home, and their sponsors would say, wait for the liquor store lights to turn off before you send her upstairs, and that's love. They sat there with a smelly, detoxing alcoholic until the liquor store lights turned off and talked to me about themselves. See, I had this wired jaw for 3 months. The first 3 months I was here, I couldn't talk. I had to learn to listen. It was really a blessing in disguise. Mike, is this your water? Which side did you drink out of? Are you sick? I mean, I know you're sick, but are you, you know, okay. So I started my road in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was August 20th, 1975. I didn't know it was going to be my sobriety date. Somebody gave me a book, and I wrote it in pencil. They said, write today's date. It's still in there in pencil. And this man gave me this book, and I gave him my last quarter because I didn't want to owe you anything. And I paid him off. It took me about a quarter every other week to pay this man off. And his name was Maurice, and he was a wonderful man in our group, and he's not with us anymore. He's in the big meeting in the sky with Duffy's dad. And Maurice was a writer, and he was, he was published. He had books, and he was so kind to me. People were so kind to me. The man in my life who's been in my life for 8 years, his name is Casey, and he's 12 and a half years old, and he's a wonderful man. He's my soulmate, and he's got a son who's, I think, about 27, who's been living on the streets, and he just finally came back to his mother's house and knocked at the door and said, I think I want to try this. And he's been sober since before Christmas, but he's like catatonic. He has been desocialized. He's been living on his own because he knew if he'd be around people, he'd drink. So he's been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been calling the people, because it's outside of Los Angeles a ways, and I've been calling some people up there saying, go get him and take him to a meeting. He's incapable of calling. He's just incapable of picking up and dialing the phone because he sits there and stares. He's out of it, you know. And he had sobriety at one time, and the light was on, so I know it can go on again. And the people are saying to me, well, they went and picked him up and took him to a meeting, and they said, well, have you thought of medication? And it's, you know, Sean was talking about that. He's like I was. He's a newcomer. You know, come give him a chance before you put him on something. Nobody home for the first 3 months I was sober. Absolutely nobody home. I've got a picture of me, 3 months sober, and I am dead-eyed. But people forget what it's like to have a real newcomer in your midst. I mean, I used to get some of those 12-step calls where you go out and you sit at the side of the bed in a seedy hotel with, you know, the man passed out and the woman wanting sobriety, and she's drunk, and you drag her to a meeting and she disrupts, and you tell her to be quiet, and, you know, you give her your number, she wakes, she probably comes to after, you know, a good blackout with all this AA literature, and, you know, I get to go out in the middle of the night. I used to do that, but I don't get those 12-step calls so much anymore. If you get a chance, grab hold. Grab hold of a newcomer and don't ask them, gee, do you want to go to tomorrow night's meeting? Call me. Come. I'll pick you up. You know? Because if you would have given me a choice, I didn't feel worth even coming here. You didn't give me the choice. You said, don't drink and use and we'll pick you up tomorrow night. And that's just what they did. They moved me out and moved me on somebody's floor, and I was on this merry-go-round of sobriety thrown on it before I even wanted to go. When I kind of came to at 31 days of sobriety, I realized I didn't have to raise my hand anymore. And I went, 31 days? There's no way. There's no way. That was absolutely God's grace, and I didn't even know I was being touched by God's grace, but it was within the fellowship that I started to get better. I knew nothing about program yet. I had to sit in here and physically get better with you and before I was even able to comprehend anything about the 12 steps or a loving God. So these people just moved me around, and I would just kind of come to meetings and stand, and I'd get to wash cups. That was my big thing because I didn't have to talk to anybody, and they put me at the sink. And this woman named June Ann drug me around a lot. June Ann was just, she was wonderful. She taught me about commitment. June Ann and I had commitments at this Wednesday night meeting. And one night, June Ann didn't show up with the cookies. And it's like, June Ann isn't here yet, you know. And the meeting's going to start, and where are the cookies? And something's wrong, and she's always here. And pretty soon this cop car pulls up, and this cop gets out with this bag of cookies and brings it up to the meeting and says, this is for cookies from June Ann for the meeting. And we see June Ann in the back seat cuffed. You know, she had gone out to buy the cookies for the meeting, and she had bought the cookies for the meeting, but she had shoplifted some candy bars for herself. And but she had somehow convinced the policeman to bring the cookies to the meeting. So she had a commitment. And I love June Ann. She used to drag me around to all the posh Beverly Hills meeting with my crooked face and my wired jaw and my broken hirachis and stand me by the coffee pot to shake hands with people, you know. A couple years ago, I went to Atlanta to just share at a conference, and I found June Ann. And she had no sobriety. She hadn't had sobriety, and she was dying of cancer, and I got to spend some time with her and thank her. And I sent my Christmas card off that year, and I came back deceased. And there's so many people that are standing with me. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants here. You with your 43 years, and table with all the 20s, and people that didn't get to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and stay. I feel true gentlemen, thank you. I feel so blessed to be their representative. And it means a lot to me that today I get to be their representative. And I carry with in my heart all the people that aren't here anymore. And it's just today. That's what we've got, is just today. I can't live on yesterday's accomplishments, on yesterday's steps. Sean gave such a brave talk last night about where he is today in his life. Because I know that if I'm 20, 21 years sober and I'm having some problems, I can call him, because he's one of the braves. He's one of the scouts out there letting me know you can still grow and change and take risks and deal with life on life's terms and stay sober with the help of you and Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I had that looking good thing built inside of me for a long time. And I was also numb of feeling. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was involved in an active group where they just kind of pulled me along. And pretty soon I got a sponsor, and pretty soon I started working the steps, and pretty soon I got a job, and pretty soon I got a $24 a week room, and pretty soon I got a car and car insurance, and you know, and just things started to go slowly for me, and this sponsor made me work the steps, and I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea, but she seemed to be really happy that I was doing this with her. So, you know, I wanted to please Janet. She was half Mexican, half Indian, and mean anyway. So she was very fluorescent. Janet would wear hot pants that were pink and green bows and, you know, socks this color, and I could always find her in a room. It was like where the bright spot was, you know. She had this laugh like a duck. She'd quack, 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 quack. She'd laugh. And she was embarrassing. I'd go, oh, God, Janet, please don't laugh like that. And I remember one night I was in a meeting, and she wasn't there, and I was really disappointed because I had to share some big discovery I had that day. And all of a sudden, in the back of the room, I heard this quack, 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 quack. And this feeling of being safe came over me, you know? I hadn't felt safe in a long time, and I started to feel safe with you. And these things were starting to happen to me without my even wanting it. I was thrown in the middle of you and pulled along. And nobody said, do you want to work the steps? Nobody said, do you want to go to a meeting? They just said, come on. Just come on. Welcome and come on. And we got to the third step, and we did it on her living room floor, and I remember it was daylight and the kids were in the house, and it was embarrassing and I didn't know what I was doing or what it was all about. And I remember we got up and she hugged me, you know, we were on our knees doing the step, and then she hugged me, and she came to about here on me, you know, and she kept hugging me. She wouldn't let go, and you know, this is embarrassing, let go already. And you know, then pretty soon it started to feel good, and I'm thinking, I must be gay, you know, I must be gay. I had a really true feeling, and I didn't know what it was, you know, I'm the kind of person that would lay in bed 2 weeks later and come to and go, I should have said this, you know, I just was not living in the moment, I just emotionally was so short-circuited. I remember I didn't know I had defects of character until I was married a couple of years, you know, and because they were always his, they were never mine, you know, and I remember a night I hit him on the head with a flashlight, and as I picked the flashlight up from his head, I said, oh, this is anger. You know, it was. I went and called my sponsor, and we were like jumping up and down, and he's mad, rubbing the bump on his head, you know? It took me a very long time, is what I'm telling you. It took me a very long time. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous didn't say, oh, you're not getting it yet. You don't know what's on page 133 yet, you know? And they told me to go home and read page 449 a lot, and I had the second edition big book. And Dr. Paul's acceptance is not in the second edition big book, so I would go home and read Joe's Woes. And I had no idea what they were talking about. And I thought I was too dumb for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't tell anybody I didn't know. I just, oh yeah, I know what they're talking about. Okay, you know, read page 449, you know. Until I got a third edition big book, I didn't know what they were talking about. And, you know, but thank God nobody here ever said to you, it's time for you to go now. You know, they said it's time for you to work another step. You worked that fourth step before your year sober, my group, because of peer pressure. And Pat Yo had 8 days less than me. And every time I'd think about getting drunk, I'd think, no, she came in 8 days after me, took all my thunder, and got the old-timers' attention. I mean, she was smelled nicer, she talked nicer, she was nicer to be around. And so I resented Pat a little bit. And every time I think about drinking, I think, don't want to have less time than Pat. No? And it seemed like she had done her fourth step when she was 6 months sober, and her fifth step, and every time they reached chapter five, she'd turn around and look at me. That little blue-lipped look, like, I've done mine. I know you haven't done yours. And I remember when I finally did my fifth step, and I got to sit a little deeper in that seat that night, and when Pat turned to look at me, I just gave her a big smile. You know, it felt good. I felt a little sense of worth. I'm an empty glass when I got here, and you know, eyedropper full by eyedropper full by eyedropper full. That glass has been filled, you know. Sometimes it was just a little drop, and sometimes on a day when it's hard and you want to kill the world, you don't want to show up for work, you got the brain tumor, you call your sponsor, she says, diet work will give you an AA funeral, diet home, no funeral, and hang up the phone on you, you know. So then you're mad and you go out there and you do everything right, and I'm going to show her, and you show up at a meeting and you start to feel a little better, and you go home and you hit your knees and you go to bed and you sleep well. You get a big eyedropper full of self-worth that day because it was hard staying sober, but you worked your program, you know. And one day when I was 7 years sober, that glass got full. And I didn't know when it was going to get full. I didn't know that standing at the podium taking my 7-year birthday cake from my sponsor, I was going to get this feeling from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes that I was complete, that I was a child of God and I was complete. I didn't know that was going to happen. That was such a high that I thought, if this is what they're talking about, I want more of this, because I'm a more person. And I didn't know that was going to happen, but it happened. That glass got full. So on the days I think of doing something self-destructive, I think of taking my silver platter and my beautiful glass full of my sweat and holding it out there and saying, go ahead, knock it on the floor. I don't know if I could start over again. You know, I spill a little here and there and have to fill it up again. But I don't want to just knock it on the floor to break and put it all over. I just can't do that. You know, I have worked for my good feelings here. So on page 25, it's a simple set of spiritual tools laid at my feet. You said, here's the tools. You got to do the work. I could show you how. I can tell you what that wrench is for, what that socket is for, but I can't do the work for you. I had never in my whole life done anything to make myself feel better about me. It was always ingested or taken. It was never worked for with my own sweat and tears and God's love. And I have done that in Alcoholics Anonymous because you showed me how. You're my family of understanding. I went to a lot of people who, Sean talked about it too, pointed the finger and said, you should do this. And if you could do this, things would be better. You didn't do that. You said, welcome, and you showed me where the tools were. The 12 steps have allowed me to walk in God's sunlight, to walk in the sunlight of the Spirit. That's absolutely what has happened to me, is the 12 steps. I got to get a new sponsor when I was 5 years sober, and Ginny was wonderful. And I had gotten married when I was 2 years sober. I had done my amends. I got to had my father walk me down the aisle when I married another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and had a wonderful, wonderful wedding. At the end of the day, he looked at me and said, Sharon, look at your life. You got it made. I thought, Dad's giving me approval here. Earthquake time. Angels are going to sing. But what happened was I agreed with him because I had enough worth to agree with him, to look him in the eye and say, yeah, Dad, you're right. I got it made here. And things were still a little tense between me and my dad. And Jenny said, well, why don't you call him up and ask him if you can pay him back the money you owe him? I thought, well, how do you know I owe him any money, you know? Somebody talked about sponsor school. You know, I think they kind of go to sponsor school, and they have this little format that they figure out. So I said, okay, I'll do that. So I called him up, and I thought, well, he'll take a while to get back to me, I know. And wrong. He had a figure ready for me, you know? I can just imagine a calculator tape stuck on page 77 here, you know? If Sharon calls, give her the bottom line. He had been to a meeting, bought the book, read it, and knew that I'd call someday. And I called her back, and I said, he told me it was this much is too high and he was too fast, and I had a new resentment. She said she didn't care, lovingly, of course. That's the way they are. And so I set out on calling him. I called him back, and he accepted my terms, and I set out sending him this check every month. And he accepted those terms, and I sent that check off, and my dad always got that check on time. Even on the months I didn't think I'd have it, even on the months I whined to my sponsor, you know, even on the months I just, it'd stick in my hand before I put it in the mailbox, you know. He didn't know what I was going through. He didn't need the money. It was hard on me to do this. You know, he didn't know what went through all that. I just stuck that in the mail every month on time. And I did it for 3¾ years. And the sponsor also asked me if I wanted to really heal the relationship with my dad. You know, they wait for you to be a little willing, and then they want more. You know? And I have a sponsor louder than my head. I hope to God you got one too. I mean, thank God they're louder than my head, because she said, I want you to put a note in with that check about your life. Every time you send a check, you put a note in. And I said, my dad doesn't care about my life. He's got all these other successful children. She said, do it anyway. Lovingly, of course. So, you know, it was on little tiny pieces of paper, 3 sentences for a while. And then, I don't know when it happened, but I would find myself in the card store picking out a card for my dad. Now, I don't know when the Father's Day cards got easier to pick out. You know, I don't know when those things happened. But I know that I sent that check and that note about my life every month to my dad for 3 3/4 years. And that he picked up the phone and called me. My dad picked up the phone and dialed my number and called me between Christmas and New Year's. And he said, "Merry Christmas, Sharon. I don't want your money anymore. Your debt with me is free and clear." And that would have been enough for me right there. But he added the sentence that made all the difference because of a sponsor who wanted more for me than I wanted for myself. He said, "Don't stop sending me your notes." And me and my dad, guilt-free, got to walk into a brand new relationship because of the guidance of a sponsor and working the amends step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I get to go home and be his little girl, one I never was. And I get to go home and weed his garden with him, you know, and be proud of his tomatoes and be proud of who my dad is and that I'm his daughter. And I get to send my son there every summer to spend time with them, too. And I'm so blessed to have healed the relationships with my parents. My mother gets to sleep at night because of you. My marriage, I had an 8-year marriage. I had a baby in 1984. I was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been to Al-Anon because he became a punk rocker at one time. And I tried. I remember we went to a Cramps concert and I made a My Doll shirt and spiked my hair and, you know, and they were slam dancing, you know. It's like, I've been there, done that. I want to punch people, you know. It's like standing against the wall like this. And, you know, he was like hanging beads and listening to the Doors and incense burning and drawing psychedelic. And this man's sober and going to flotation tanks. And, you know, I went to Al-Anon and had to learn to not, you know, burn up his dead Kennedy's records in the oven. And because I had to call my Al-Anon sponsor, and she said, "Go buy him another one." And because of that, one night I walked into my Al-Anon meeting, and there he was learning to release me. And our relationship started again. And out of that fresh start we had with each other, a child was born. And he had all his fingers and all his toes and looked up at me and smiled with my little dimple, and I knew he was mine. And God gave me a gift. And that feeling of motherhood I never thought I wanted or could have took me over. And things were really good. I was sponsoring this nun, and that's a whole story in itself. And so I would go to this church to wait for her, and we had the baby baptized, and it seemed like they were talking about peace and love. And you know, so I started taking my God in with me into this church, and I was comfortable in there. And so that was some healing that I didn't expect to happen. And because, see, my first God was Beacon's moving van. It just seemed to work, you know. Whenever I see him today, it still works. I know I'm not in charge. Oh, there's a Beacon's truck. Oh, thank God I'm not in charge. You know, it seems to work. But God has become within me. God has become a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. God is my angel on my shoulder I get to take wherever I go. And at 10 years of sobriety, my sponsor got off a plane with 21 days. She'd been smoking pot in Paris. And my husband decided to walk out the door and have somebody else. And I asked a man named Clancy to be my sponsor because he was just there. You know, he was the head of our group, and he was just there. And he was louder than my head that year, and I'm so glad because I wanted to run. I really wanted to run. I felt betrayed. I became the victim again. I was insane. All my babies that were married jumped ship. I started sponsoring really crazy people, and I'd stick them all in the car, and we'd go to Sacramento to speak. We'd drive 4 or 5 hours, you know, and I wouldn't even let them go to the bathroom. Hold it, you know, it's just like, ugh. Every time, like, you know, the Stones or Bruce Springsteen would come on, I'd sob. I'd have to change the channel, you know, and I was just out there in Southern California sobbing my way through this year, and nobody said it's time for you to leave. Nobody said, you can't stay sober through this. He had a new woman, and they seemed happy together. And one Saturday night, I was on my way with 2 hot cups of black coffee to see how spiritual they really were. And my sponsor happened to be there. He's never in town on Saturday, but he happened to be there. He saw the trajectory of where I was going, and he saw the look in my eye. And he stopped me, and he took the coffee out of my hands, and he said, "Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace." You know, and I gave him my one finger wave to dignity and grace because I didn't care about it at the moment. But he added something louder than my head. He said, "So that you can be an example to others." I heard him. And I stopped self-destructing, and I started to work the steps, and I started to be quiet, and I started to sit in my place and be of service again. And what happened 1 year, 1 month, and 18 days later, when I was sitting in that Catholic church waiting for Sister Sheila so we could go to dinner, I had a healing. And I knew I was going to be okay, and I got to walk through the new doorway. You know, it was just a hallway I was in. I wasn't thrown out in the woods. I wasn't in a ditch. I was just in the hallway. It's called growth. It's just called growth. You know, if you're in the hallway, look at who's next to you. Take off your blinders and look at who's next to you and say, why are you in the hallway? Get out of yourself for a while. Listen to them. You know, and then you know that when the next doorway cracks, it's somebody's turn, because your turn will come. You will get through the hallway. And the vista is even more beautiful always. Every time I've walked through some pain, it's been a more beautiful view on the other side. So I got through the hallway, and you know, he married this woman, had a baby, and there I was at their baby's first birthday party in the kitchen dishing out ice cream, you know, thinking, how did I end up here? And I started to like her a little bit, and I would give her my son's clothing as she, you know, he would grow out. I would give it to his little half-brother, Daryl, you know. So Daryl would wear Wesley's clothing, and we would go to things together with the kids, and she really got to be a good friend of mine. And I thought, how did this happen? Only with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'll tell you, only with the program. And it's just, it's been a lot of years now. And I gave her a cake when she was 10 years sober, and she gives me a cake. She'll give me one this August, I hope. And it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. She is one of my best friends. And it's been a little easier now that they're divorced to be her best friend. But he's 20 years sober, and he went on to wife number three, who's in Al-Anon, and they seem to be doing well together. And, you know, he's sponsoring a lot of people, and he got a guy named Clint to be a sponsor after he had a heart attack. It kind of pushed him to the wall. And, you know, when he had this heart attack, I went into the hospital, and I told his, you know, my son, Wesley, I said, your dad may look funny in there. And we walked in there, and Wesley went up and grabbed his hand, and, you know, Al was laying there with all the tubes and this funny stuff, and Cindy was in there reading him the big book, and Wesley just started talking to his dad, and I fell apart, and I thought, why am I crying here? I mean, I'm healed from this relationship. It's been a lot of years. I've got this great guy in my life. Why am I crying? And he started to have leg cramps, and the nurse wouldn't come right away, so Cindy and I started being of service. And I realized it was like the light came on. You never wished him all the happiness and joy and prosperity that he wants out of life. You never forgave him and gave him that. So I got to give him that day. And I got to really walk free that day, because you taught me how to be of service no matter what's going on in my life. I've got a great job. I've been there 8 years. They think I'm terrific. They don't know anything about you. They just see the end result of it. You know, I show up, I suit up, and I know how to put a smile on my face. They say, good morning, how are you? I don't tell them. I really don't tell them what goes on in the squirrel cage. I say, I'm fine, thank you, how are you? You know, I get to come here at the end of a day like I used to run into a bar for relief. I get to come be with you because there's God in your eyes, and I need to see God in your eyes. I've got the greatest kid in the world. He's going to be 11 this month, and we had a hard time for a while, and he had a hard time. And he looked at me when he was in kindergarten and said, you're a mean mom. You know, and it was hard. It was hard raising him and trying to be, you know, at home the only one a lot of the time. And I learned how to play Legos with him and put together puzzles and do a cartwheel, show him I could still do one, and, you know, shoot hoops with him. And you know, he wrote me a note at the end of last school year. He said, Mom, you're the greatest mom a kid could ever want. And he said, you're so great the kids ask me if they can have you, you know. And he points out Beacon's trucks on the road, and when they were reading A.A. Milne in school, he stuck up his hand and he said, I know all about A.A. My mommy's in A.A., you know? And he's just the greatest kid, and I love him to death. And but I allow him to skin his knees and get up. You know, I'm there to wipe the tears and put on the Band-Aid. You know, I'm not standing there getting him as he's fallen. You know, he's got to know about life, you know? And you taught me that. You taught me how to release and how to love. And you taught me that, that this man in my life I can love and not have to move in the clothes and, you know, get obsessed with each other. And I've been with Casey 8 years, and it just gets better. We got to go back to New Orleans a couple years ago, and the woman I sponsor that used to drink with, Robin, was there on her 40th birthday at Antoine's, and we got to go have dinner at Antoine's. I always wanted to eat at Antoine's. So I was always too drunk, never made it. And we had the celebration of sobriety. When we walked down Bourbon Street to go 12-step, a blues singer we know that needs us. I was looking in those bars and I saw me sitting there, just seconds and inches between me and that person on that bar stool. And there I was with God's glow and the man I love on my arm. It couldn't have been better. I knew. I absolutely knew that God loves me much more than I could ever love myself. But for the grace of God, I would be sitting in that bar vomiting on my shoes. And I used to think freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. You know, that was my cry with my my backpack with a Be Here Now book. You know, my one-fingered peace sign and dying of alcoholism. You know, and I find out that freedom is coming to be with you and watch the light go on in the eyes. I need to be close to the miracle. I need to work with others. The story about the little boy that was the only child and so happy to be the only child, and then he found out he was going to have a sister. You know, and he was obsessed with this child in utero, even before it came out, and obsessed with it. And finally this child was born, and he was obsessed with his sister, and he kept telling his mom and dad, I got to see her alone. You know, and they said, yeah, right. You know, maybe later, you know. And finally he convinced them that I got to talk to her alone. It's important, you know, this little five-year-old boy. And they didn't want him to hurt her, so they let him go into the room alone, but they listened at the door and watched. And he got right up to the crib and whispered in his sister's ear, quick, tell me about God, I'm starting to forget. And it's like, I got to be close to the miracle here. I absolutely have to be close to the newcomer and watch the light go on, because I need to know that God is working in your life as he's working in my life. I see God in my actions, but I get to see God in your eyes. You know, freedom is the 12 steps. Freedom is allowing me to have a loving God work in my life. Freedom is allowing me to have the worth to allow you to love me. Freedom is just coming to Olympia, Washington, and allowing the God in me to touch the God in you. Thank you.